Good afternoon, Regent Radio. This is Ome Sama Rahimtullah, joined on the line by Dr. Gerald Horn, who is somewhere in the streets of Chicago. Is that right, Dr. Horn?
That is absolutely correct. The National Archives Regional Branch beginning to do some research on pro-Tokyo Negroes in Chicago in the 1930s.
Another prolific work to come out soon. Just to let our listeners know, it is Wednesday morning, so that's where we're at in terms of the news. And we'll start off, and I know you love Toronto gossip, Gerald, so we'll start off with a little Rob Ford update. And the latest is that as much as he's trying to kind of make this crack cocaine video go away, the ramifications of it are still coming out in Toronto. And just recently, I think it was yesterday, he fired Councillor Jay Robinson from his executive committee. And she was the only critic of Rob Ford on the committee. So that was a really blazing move. He said that he did that because he had asked her to stop her public comments about asking him to step down. So it's a very partisan move in that sense. And, you know, it limits the amount of women that are on the executive committee or any type of executive committee in the city. So that's where we're at with Rob Ford. Also, that he had been sued for defamation by a pub owner, and that case was thrown out, and he actually was awarded some of the court costs that he had to endure in that case. So that's not very good news. And he also has continued what has become his annual tradition of voting against all six of Toronto's community grants programs, if you can believe. Even his brother votes in favor of it. The deputy mayor votes in favor of it. His excuse, and he's been doing this ever since he's mayor, is that grants are like handouts.
Oh, I see.
So
what happened? What's the latest on the tape?
Well,
the tape from smoking crack.
Apparently, the tape has disappeared. The guy who has the tape has disappeared. They can't find him. No movement on that per se.
Oh, I see. And so he may survive then.
Pardon me?
Rob Ford may survive.
I don't know. I hope not. But there was a poll that came out, maybe it was a week and a half ago, that said that his popularity since this has not even dwindled.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So the folks, the suburban folks are still behind him.
How do you explain that?
I don't know, right-wing crazies? Like, because people were saying, okay, so he smokes crack. Whatever, he still has a fiscal policy that we can get behind.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, I've often thought, at least south of the border, that a lot of this right-wing noise about so-called moral values and all the rest, they only mean that for politicians who are not right-wing. That is to say, if you aren't right-wing, they'll give you a pass. Because ultimately what they're concerned about is really cutting taxes for the wealthy and things of that sort. And they just use these moral issues as a club against non-conservative politicians. And perhaps that principle operates north of the border as well.
And the idea, I mean, for me, it's always been confusing in my mind. And what's the point of the city? It's not a business. It uses its tax money to provide services. It's not in the business of saving money. And, you know, being cost efficient or whatnot. And so I think it's not even that. It's like a just total misconception about what government services are supposed to be, in my mind. Anyways.
Well, keep in mind that the wealthy, they can send their children to private schools. They don't have to use public transportation. Mm-hmm. They don't even have to use the public water supply. Mm-hmm. They don't even have to use the public electricity supply. They can get their own generators. So from their point of view, taxes are for the poor and working class services, not for their services, which they can pay for out of their own pocket.
That's true. I guess I didn't really think of it in that way. Moving on to the continent, the African continent, a few things going on. First, the British High Courts decided that they would recognize the torture that Mau Mau reparation seekers have been asking them to recognize, that during the colonial administration, Mau Mau freedom fighters were subjected to torture, rape, and other crimes, and that the British government needs to take responsibility. They have gone so far as, quote-unquote, recognizing they're going to build a fancy little statue. Everyone who is a claimant will receive only £3,000, which is nothing, and only living survivors, which it's hard to even find living survivors because, of course, this was happening in the 50s, and, you know, these people are old. But they also went as far as saying that they will not take legal responsibility, that legal responsibility of the colonial government, as weird as this may sound, gets transferred to the Kenyan Republic.
Yeah, it's a very limited decision in one sense, as you accurately state. But on the other hand, it may very well serve as a legal precedent for freedom fighters in what was then Malaya, because one of the most bitter struggles that the British Empire fought in the 1950s, actually contemporaneously with the struggle in Kenya, was the struggle in Southeast Asia against the Malayan freedom fighters, now Malaysia. And then during the same time, there was a bit of struggle going on in Aden, now part of Yemen, now the seat of a fierce drone war led by the United States. And there, of course, was a contemporaneous struggle in Cyprus. I mean, I think that there are a number of struggles across the globe that this Kenyan president may be relevant towards. And that's not even to talk about whether or not this is relevant to the descendants of enslaved Africans in the Caribbean and North America. That is to say, the legal, the expert witness on behalf of the so-called Mau Mau defendants, Professor Caroline Elkins of Harvard University, said in an interview on BBC that what was involved in this Kenyan case was, and this is more or less a quote, reparations with a capital R. Now, if she is correct, then obviously she knows as much about this case as any person, then if Britain pays reparations to East Africans in Kenya, well, then why not Britain pay reparations to those in the Caribbean, for example? Now, of course, with regard to the United States and Canada, I'm sure they would say what they said in the Kenyan case, that responsibility has been transferred to Ottawa and Washington, and London can therefore wash its hands of the matter. But seriously, this is a very important decision that merits very profound study.
Most definitely, it is setting up a very important precedent. But I guess maybe, yeah, obviously, it's not going far enough. But definitely a very important turn of events in that case. Moving now to Niger, Libya, Chad, Nigeria. Your comments on the link going on there. And I was wondering what you were saying about that. I'm like, is that the Mali link or AFRICOM or uranium?
Well, it's all of the above, and it's also the fact that now what's happened is that southern Libya has become a new seat of so-called Islamic fundamentalism that is then spreading into Niger and across the Sahel region of Africa. We know that as a direct result of the conflict in Libya, you had some of these forces who had been contained by Colonel Gaddafi moving into Mali, which necessitated, according to Paris, a French military intervention that is still ongoing and presumably will involve forces from the Economic Community of West African States to suppress that rebellion in northern Mali, a rebellion that is still taking place. I should add as a footnote that though we had thought that all of the manuscripts, the important manuscripts going back hundreds of years in Timbuktu, had been saved because these militants thought that they should be destroyed, well, there was this very nice story about how they had been hidden away, but apparently that story was overblown. Apparently some of these priceless manuscripts were torched by the militants as they were retreating. And it's quite a loss to humanity. It's oftentimes said that when an elder dies, it's the equivalent of a library being burned down. Well, if that's the case, when these manuscripts are burned, I guess that's the equivalent of an entire archive being burned down. In any case, you may recall that just a few days ago in Niger, you had an attack on a uranium facility that supplies uranium for the French electricity industry. You had an attack on a military encampment that led to many deaths. And so I think that at the end of the day, it's fair to say that this conflict in Libya, this NATO war in Libya in 2011, has proven to be an unmitigated disaster. And sadly, it seems that the NATO forces have not learned their lesson, because it seems as if they want to replicate that disaster in Syria.
And I want us to move on to talking about Syria. But before that, in terms of the uranium mines in Niger, like these attacks and then the fear of further attacks are an excuse for the increased militarization, so that the U.S., for example, has a special force now stationed in northern Niger at a uranium mine to protect those interests. And it just seems that the militarization seems to be increasing on the continent.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, it's clear that the U.S.-led NATO forces, they're still operating on a 19th century model. That is to say, gunboat diplomacy, as it used to be called. That is to say that the way that they choose to deal with Africa is from the barrel of a gun, through the barrel of a gun, and that way they can get cheap commodities and cheap natural resources like uranium. I dare say that that model is outmoded. It's a model that only breeds conflict and warfare. And it's a model, ultimately, that's going to lead to an even bigger disaster that has been created to this very day.
And just before we move on to Turkey and Syria, Nelson Mandela health is getting worse and worse. Again, he's in the hospital this week, and it's the third time this year. Your comments on Mandela and his ailing health?
Well, it's a very sad and tragic case, in the sense that his health problems are not only due, shall we say, to being in his 90s, which of course is something of an overstatement, because many people, as we know, in their 90s are hale and hearty, but they're a direct result of the tuberculosis that he contracted while a prisoner for 27, 28 years on Robben Island. And he has not been able to shake tuberculosis, and it's still ravaging his system. And it's something of the ultimate metaphor. That is to say that the father of modern South Africa is now seemingly going down slowly as a result of the ravages of apartheid, just as South Africa itself is having difficulty getting on its feet as a thriving economy, not least because of the ravages of apartheid, not least being the systematic deprivation of education, in particular to the African majority during the apartheid era.
And your updates on updates and analysis on Syria and Turkey.
Well, with regard to Syria, I think what's happened is this. I think that the rebels suffered a major public relations blow when the news was revealed that al-Nusra Front was affiliated with al-Qaeda of Iraq. You begin to see the air leak out of their balloon once that story was revealed some weeks ago, because it's very difficult to get public opinion on your side if you're supposedly affiliated with al-Qaeda. That's point number one. Point number two is that once Hezbollah of Lebanon entered this fray on behalf of the Damascus regime, that also was a game changer, because Hezbollah, which is this religious come political organization that wields significant influence in Lebanon, fought Israel to a standstill some 7-odd years ago, and are some of the best urban fighters, street fighters, guerrilla fighters on this small planet. And so when they entered the fray, that too attempted to turn the tide on behalf of the Damascus regime. Now you see that the Damascus regime is pushing on towards Aleppo, the second largest city, which has been a hotbed of rebel support. And probably as we speak, there's a bitter and raging conflict taking place there. As regards this Geneva conference cooked up by Moscow and Washington, well, according to the UN negotiator, everybody's on board for the conference except for the Syrians. The Syrians feel that this conflict will be won on the battlefield, not in around the table in Geneva. So the prognosis for Geneva 2.0, as it has been termed, is rather dim right now. Now, in neighboring Turkey, you may have seen the headlines just today, Wednesday, concerning how the Erdogan government has moved in with force to clear out the demonstrators from the central point of Istanbul, where they had been gathered for days now. Mr. Erdogan, I would say, is acting in a way that we tend to expect from him, that is to say, in a very forceful, if not authoritarian manner, but clearing away the demonstrators, I don't think will clear away the problem. The problem is that in a state that prides itself on its secularism, going back to the founding of modern Turkey in the 1920s under Kemal Atatürk, Mr. Erdogan is pursuing the so-called soft Islamist policies of restraints on alcohol, restraints on women's rights, and all of the rest, and that's creating a very important and a very potent conflict that is going to be very difficult to restrain. And not only that, as we've said a number of times on Radio Regent, Mr. Erdogan has a lengthening list of antagonists. He doesn't get along with Syria because he has been supporting the rebels. That is to say, he doesn't get along with the Damascus regime. He has bad relations with Israel. He doesn't get along necessarily with France because France has turned thumbs down in terms of Turkey entering the European Union. He has a conflict with Greece over Cyprus. He doesn't get along very well with the United States. Protestations to the contrary, because early in his administration, Mr. Erdogan basically turned thumbs down on entering the disastrous Iraq war on the side of Washington. He doesn't get along with Iran because of conflicts over Iraq. He doesn't get along with Iraq because Mr. Erdogan has been catering to the Kurdish minority. As a matter of fact, Turkey, at least the Turkish elite, might be the biggest winner from the U.S.-sponsored invasion of Iraq, since energy-rich Kurdistan in northern Iraq is now basically, in a de facto sense, being dominated by the Turkish enterprises. So it's like a detective story. If Mr. Erdogan goes down, there's so many different suspects, it's going to be difficult to find who was the ultimate culprit.
And I mean, I've been talking to my Turkish friends about what's going on. And as much as it is, an issue of maybe Erdogan's pursuit of, as you call it, soft Islamist policies, for them and for the protesters, for the people on the streets, it's more an issue of an access to public discourse and access to public space, and not so much falling maybe on this very easy dichotomous division between secularist and Islamist.
Well, yes. I mean, look, I mean, I think if you look at the people in the streets, there are people who are Kurdish nationalists. Of course, the Turkish regime has suppressed the Turkish minority for decades now, and many of those are gathered in the center of Istanbul. You have secularists, you have communists, you had workers on strike. They feel that they needed a wage increase. You have people, environmentalists, who feel that green space is being eroded. You have people who are objecting to the fact that the Alevi minority in Turkey has been suppressed. And in fact, Mr. Erdogan was in the process of building yet another bridge across the Bosphorus in Turkey in honor of a leader of Turkey who had murdered countless numbers of Alevis. So, as I said, I mean, the list is long in terms of the grievances of Turks against Mr. Erdogan. The list is long in terms of the external critics of Mr. Erdogan. He has managed to unite not only many Turks against them, but many people outside of Turkey against them.
And moving on now to Central America, a Nicaraguan congressional committee has approved giving a China-based consortium the concessions to building and operating a canal between the Pacific and the Caribbean, which could rival the Panama Canal. And I know that you have an interesting take on the role of China, so let's hear it.
Well, you know, it's Chinese interests who would be basically building this proposed canal, which could basically make the Panama Canal, which is dominated by the United States and Panama, irrelevant. The Panama Canal is important because if you're trying to ship goods from Asia to the east coast of the United States, oftentimes the ships go through the Panama Canal. Just as if you're trying to ship goods from Europe to the west coast of the United States, these ships go through the Panama Canal. Now, from Washington's point of view, if China is controlling a canal of that magnitude, it is potentially a game changer. But this is part of what I call China's pivot to the Americas. Much has been made about the U.S. pivot to Asia, which is, you know, no doubt taking place. But I think people really need to pay attention to this Chinese pivot to the Americas. Before talking with Mr. Obama in Southern California just a few days ago, Mr. Xi Jinping was meeting in Trinidad and Tobago with leaders of many Caribbean states, including Barbados, Jamaica, etc. The aid from Beijing to these Caribbean states is flowing like molten lava. That is to say, China is doling out gifts, or I should say aid packages, in quite hefty sums. For example, Trinidad is going to have built a major hospital, which will probably wind up being the most significant hospital in that small Caribbean nation of 1.1 million people. Mr. Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, went from Trinidad to Costa Rica, where similar deals were brokered. And of course, here you should reference the proposed Nicaraguan Canal, because Costa Rica is a neighbor of Nicaragua. And then from there to Mexico, where all sorts of trade deals were brokered. Washington was trying to basically have Mexico serve as something of a counterpoise or a counterweight to China, that is to say, cheap goods moving from China to Mexico. But apparently what may wind up happening is a new thriving relationship between Mexico and China, something that Canada should think about in light of all the publicity that the North American Free Trade Agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico has received in recent years. So it's a major situation that's unfolding in the Americas with China leading the way.
And you wanted to talk about the new role of Japan.
Well, what's happening is that the NATO countries, led by the United States and, of course, including Canada, are really petrified about the rise of China. And so just as during the Cold War, they were able to enlist China against Moscow, now they're trying to enlist Japan against China. The problem with that strategy is that the Japan ruling elite has a mind of its own, shall we say, and basically what they're going to do is milk the NATO countries for all its worth. The NATO countries have acquiesced, for example, to a weakening of the yen, which has allowed for a recharging of the Japanese economy, which grew over 3% in the last quarter, which was, of course, much faster than most of the Western European nations. With the weakening of the Japanese yen, you see, correspondingly, a weakening of the South Korean economy, because they compete in different markets, Samsung versus Sony, for example, Hyundai versus Toyota, for example. And the weakening of the South Korean economy is really softening up South Korea to try to negotiate more seriously with North Korea, which had been taking place for the last few days, although I understand that just today the negotiations were broken off abruptly. What I'm trying to suggest is that I think that trying to pump up Japan as some sort of counterweight against China is going to end as disastrously as the previous effort to pump up China as a counterweight to Moscow. And for those who recall the period from 1941 to 1945, and I'm sure Canadians do because many Canadian lives were lost during World War II, particularly on December 8th, 1941, when Japanese troops invaded Hong Kong, well, then I think that Canadians in particular should be thinking quite seriously about what's going on in Japan right now.
And finally, in the, I mean, we have 5 minutes, so we can talk about this a lot, but Edward Snowden is, of course, the NSA worker who revealed the classified NSA spy program to The Guardian and The Washington Post. Of course, this is the PRISM surveillance program. He is currently, apparently, in Hong Kong, but checked out of his hotel on Monday. So we're not, I don't know, I guess U.S. surveillance is not really sure where he is. And the U.S. is demanding Hong Kong to extradite Edward Snowden to the U.S. to face trial.
Well, there's so many angles to the story, it's difficult to know where to start. Canadians, in the first place, should think seriously about this PRISM program. Apparently, what happens is that, for example, the United States will monitor the email traffic of Canadians, the Skype traffic, the text traffic, perhaps the phone conversations, and then turn over what they find to the Canadians. And then the Canadians can then say, well, we're not eavesdropping on our citizens. And it's technically correct. It's the United States who's eavesdropping on Canadian citizens on behalf of Ottawa. And then likewise, what would happen is that the United States would do the same thing vis-a-vis Britain, and presumably I would imagine it's going the other way. That is to say that British intelligence may be eavesdropping on U.S. nationals. Now, we all know that even before the scandal erupted, there was this very close relationship between intelligence forces in the United States, Britain, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and that they were sharing intelligence all across the board. Now, in the Financial Times, they had an article just recently that suggested that these revelations may serve to wound that latter relationship, not least because the Australians are moving closer economically to China, and they don't want to antagonize China. Another angle of this story that bears scrutiny is the fact that this scandal in part has been driven by the reality that government operations have been outsourced, if you like, to private corporations. That is to say, Booz Allen Hamilton is a private corporation that is under contract by the United States government to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens and foreign nationals. Now, when you have a major corporation taking on government, quote, responsibilities, unquote, that is to say, eavesdropping on citizens, then some detect more than a whiff of fascism involved. Another angle that needs to be pursued and thought about is the fact that there has been some doubt raised as to whether or not Mr. Snowden can actually receive the protection from Hong Kong and ultimately from Beijing, which is the ultimate authority in Hong Kong, that it's doubtful if he'll receive the protection that he envisioned. What's interesting in this regard is that Moscow has stepped forward, saying that it will provide sanctuary to Mr. Snowden. And, of course, I would direct listeners' attention to this unavoidable fact that even today, in 2013, when you had the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the ouster of the Communist Party, you still have Moscow being one of the few entities, one of the few nations, that's willing to stand up to the North Atlantic powers. I can't think of any other nation which has said that it would offer sanctuary to Edward Snowden. Certainly Canada's not going to offer sanctuary to him. Certainly the Western Europeans are not. Probably the African states are not as well. I mean, he might be able to find sanctuary in Cuba, for example, although that's doubtful. But in any event, I think that this Snowden case and the spying case reveals a very interesting aspect of what imperialism means today and what security means today.
And, I mean, another angle, I guess, that it made me think of, especially when you're talking about providing sanctuary, is the same thing that we see with Julian Assange and his kind of, you know, struggle to find sanctuary to from persecution or prosecution. But also this seeming trend of whistleblowers. We can think also of Bradley Manning, whose trial actually started last week.
Well, I should also mention that Julian Assange, like yours truly, is a regular commentator on RT, the Moscow-based television network. I should also say that it's not coincidental that these revelations about spying and eavesdropping were released not to a U.S. newspaper, but to the Guardian of London, because anybody who pays attention realizes that the U.S. media are basically under the thumb of the U.S. ruling elite. Look at how the New York Times treated Julian Assange after he turned over the WikiLeaks revelations to them. Basically, they were afraid that the U.S. ruling class would think that they had turned dangerously to the left. And so the editors of the New York Times proceeded to denounce Julian Assange after he had helped to give them an exclusive. I mean, I thought it was such a monumental example of lack of gratitude. I mean, he probably helped drive up the profits of that flagging enterprise by driving people to their website. And what did he get in return? The editors denounced him. And so Snowden, perhaps taking the cue, turns over the story to The Guardian, which leaves the New York Times and the Washington Post, I should add, with egg on their face. There are many, many lessons that emerge from this latest scandal.
And we'll definitely be following up on that in the coming weeks. But that's about the time that we have. So I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Horn, for joining us today.
Thank you. Take care. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.